Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from the archives of True West Magazine. October 2000, Halloween Edition. Brand Him Murder by Jillian Ray. It takes a lot to scare a cowboy. But even the bravest couldn't help shuddering when they heard the tale of a steer named Murder. It all began in Brewster County, Texas, in 1890, when brothers Zach and Gil Spencer were rounding up longhorns. Usually, they were the best of friends, but tempers grew short in the heat of the roundup. It was a fine-looking steer with an enormous spread of horns that started them arguing. Was it Zach's or was it Gil's? We could draw lots for him, suggested Gil. Or better still, our guns, Zach shouted. He drew his six gun out of its holster and shot his brother dead. When he saw what he had done, Zach was stricken with grief and remorse. He had gunned down his beloved brother, and all because of a steer. He lifted up Gil's body and laid it on the back of his horse. How are we going to brand the steer now? Asked one of the cowhands. Zach couldn't hold back his tears. With the same brand that's on my hide, he wept. Brand him murder and let him go. I never want to see that steer again, but I hope he haunts this mesa for the next 1,000 years. That afternoon, Gil Spencer was buried. Zach couldn't take the guilt, and after the funeral, he shot himself with the same gun that he had killed his brother. The story spread, and it wasn't long before people in the area began sighting the steer that had caused the deaths of the two young men. Anybody who saw it was fated to kill or be killed. Like the cowboy who saw the branded steer and couldn't wait to tell his two best pals, but they didn't believe him. Heat must have gone for your brain, they said. Either that or you'd been drinking. Furious at being called a liar, the cowboy drew his gun and shot them both dead. A young boy ran away from home to become a gunman. He encountered the steer, and he was so scared that his one thought was to get home fast and stay there. In the nearest small town, he went to the marshal's office to surrender his guns. Tragically, the marshal, seeing the boy coming towards him with a gun in each hand, thought he was about to be attacked and shot the poor boy down. Years later, the story of the steer was being told. Only after a while, it was said to have died and become a ghost. By 1920, it had also mysteriously turned itself into a bull, and it had roamed as far as Montana. But the murder brand was still there, as Lou Allen, a Montana rancher, could testify. He and his friend, Cole Farrell, were partners in a small spread right next to a much larger ranch, the D-Down, which belonged to a certain Faye Dow. Dow wanted Allen and Farrell's land, but they had turned down all his offers to buy it. Dow decided that if he couldn't get the land by fair means, he'd just have to get it by foul. He saw Farrell going off into town one night, then went to pay Allen a little visit. He told him that Farrell had gone to town to see Allen's sweetheart and that tonight wasn't the first time. They'd been seeing each other behind Allen's back for quite a while. It was all a pack of lies, but Dow must have been convincing, for Allen believed him and went crazy with jealousy. A six gun in his hand, he went out and waited beside the trail to ambush Farrell on his way home. Just after midnight, he heard hoofbeats on the trail and prepared himself to gun his partner down. As the hoofbeats came closer, Allen saw that it wasn't Farrell at all, but the large bull branded Murder, and it was headed straight for him. Terrified, Allen fired four shots right into its head, but what good are bullets against a ghost? Luckily for him, the phantom beast seemed to change his mind. It stopped in its tracks, then turned around and wandered off in the opposite direction. Dow had been listening impatiently for shots. As soon as he heard them, he rushed up shouting, "Did you get him? Did you kill Farrell?" When Lou Allen heard this, it all became clear to him. Dow had been lying to get the partners out of the way and take their land. Challenged, Dow denied it at first, but with Allen's gun pointing at him, he finally came clean. Knowing Allen was going to shoot him, Dow drew his own gun and hit Allen, wounding him. But Allen was the better shot. The two bullets he put in Dow killed him on the spot. The trial that followed was certainly a strange one. Allen took his own defense and told the whole story, openly admitting that he had shot Dow. There wasn't a man in the courtroom who hadn't heard the story of the ghostly animal, and they all knew that anyone who saw it was destined to kill or be killed. But, said Allen, he was grateful to the bull. Farrell had been riding toward the ranch, and if it hadn't been for the bull, he'd surely have shot him, just as Dow had planned. The bull had saved him from killing an innocent man, his best friend. It was an amazing tale, but the jury believed it, and it took just 10 minutes to acquit him. Lou Allen was the last person to encounter the ghost named Murder. From that day to this, it has never been seen again. True West Magazine, October 1989 edition. Ghost Locomotive of Kiowa Creek by Tom Jenkins. The locomotive's headlight probed the darkness as it rattled into the rain-filled night. The Kansas Pacific Freight Train No. 8, with its load of rail iron, was running late out of Denver, heading toward Kiowa, a small town about 30 miles east of the capital city. There was only a little rain at Kiowa, and because of poor communication, the town's residents had no knowledge of the heavy cloudburst off to the south, which would bring tragedy to their town. Nearby Kiowa Creek, a cottonwood-lined, wide, gentle stream, drains a large area to the south and is dry most of the time. But sometime during the night of May 21st, 1878, a churning torrent of water reached the railroad bridge not far from the town. Only the roar of the water warned of the danger of its force for those who could hear it. No one suspected the violent transformation of the usually benign creek. About midnight, a passing hobo noticed the rising water and rushed to warn the section man of the rampaging current. But it was too late. They watched helplessly as the locomotive's headlight appeared through the mist. With the noise of the steam engine, the rattle of the rails, and the racket set up by the firemen shoveling coal into the firebox, there is little wonder the engineer did not hear the raging floodwater. The torrent swallowed everything in its path, devouring the embankments supporting the bridge, along with the bridge itself, leaving the track in place, momentarily, with nothing to support it. The train roared through the pouring rain, reaching the crossing where the bridge had been, and then plunged into the watery maelstrom, the engine, tender, the freight cars, all disappearing. With daylight came the realization that the crewmen were killed, although reports vary as to the exact number of freight cars that followed the locomotive into their grave of quicksand. Some say 12 cars took the 30-foot fall from the bridge site. All agree that 3 men lost their lives that night. The engineer, John Bacon, the fireman, Fred Selden, and the brakeman, John Platt, all perished. Bacon and Platt were brothers-in-law. Searchers came from Denver to assist in locating the men. The bodies of Selden and Platt were found the next day, 1.5 miles downstream. But to find the engineer's body took more time. The volunteers searched among the metal skeletons of the freight cars, their wooden frames washed away. Around their bizarre forms, partially buried in the soggy sand, was the smash and twisted iron rail cargo. Some cars were completely buried. The locomotive was missing. Eventually, probably about May 26th, Bacon's body was found about 7 miles downstream from the accident site. In respect for the deceased men, all the Kansas Pacific locomotives in Denver were draped with mourning cloth. The little town of Kiowa changed its name to Bennett, the maiden name of the widowed sisters, Mrs. John Bacon and Mrs. Frank Selden. No one could believe that the huge locomotive, estimated to have weighed from 80,000 to 100,000 pounds, was nowhere to be found. As the creek bed continued to dry out, recovery crews searched and probed the entire area. Steel cribbing was driven into the sandy bottom, encompassing an area about 40 feet square around the mangled remains of the freight cars. Kiowa Creek was dry by then, and the men used a pump to keep the sand and water out as they recovered the freight cars and the coal tender. But there was no sign of the locomotive. It took 2 months to clear this wreckage, so that by August, the Kansas Pacific Railroad had spent a great deal of time and money in the seemingly futile search for the locomotive. At that point, stories and controversy became entangled as the mystery deepened. One dubious report told of a man named Wolf Londoner, a wholesale grocer in Denver Gadabout, who magnetized a crowbar. Using it like a divining rod, he passed the crowbar over the sands of the creek bed. At a particular spot, the crowbar quivered and plunged into the sand, dragging the man in its wake. Later, he emerged and announced he had found the lost locomotive. He said that if the Kansas Pacific Railroad would offer him a generous reward, he would retrieve the engine for them. There is no proof that anything came of it. More down-to-earth is the current contention of Robert Richardson of the Colorado Railroad Museum near Denver, who holds that the locomotive was Kansas Pacific Engine No. 51, recovered by the railroad and put back into use. Engine 51 was a 460 type, a heavy engine often used for pulling freight such as rail iron. Other historians speculate the missing locomotive would have been a 440 type, the most common engine of that era. Railroad experts suggest the records indicate the locomotive was worth about $18,000, a lot of money at the time. The Kansas Pacific Railroad was then failing, and some think it unlikely the company would have left an expensive engine in the sand. It is not probable that the railroad would have given up the search easily. Adding to this hypothesis is the alleged report that Engine 51 was rebuilt in 1881 and its number changed to 1026. The practice of renumbering extensively rebuilt engines was a common one. But there are no records substantiating the recovery. The absence of documentation, according to Richardson, is not unusual, considering the passage of 111 years and the difficulties of keeping paper records for so long. Moreover, it is possible, he thinks, for the railroad to have sent a recovery crew to get the locomotive out of the creek bed a few years later, when little or no fanfare, because it would have been old news. The railroad would have seen it merely as a costly job to be done without notifying the newspapers. The mystery did not subside in any case. No other source supports the speculation that Number 51 was on the job that fateful night. It could have been another 460 locomotive, and it could still be buried in the deep sand of Kiowa Creek, a view held by Mrs. Emma Mitchell, 79-year-old director of the Comanche Crossing Historical Society and Museum in Stroudsburg, Colorado. Mrs. Mitchell is the third generation of her family to live by Kiowa Creek. Her grandfather owned a ranch not far from the site of the wreck. My father lived in Kiowa and was 15 years old when the train was washed away. He and my uncle were hired by the Kansas Pacific to help build a grade using horses and slips, she explains, where rails were laid so the train could get through while the new bridge was being built. We know the train is here. We've lived in this area since the 1870s, and if the train had been found, we would have heard about it. In her book, Our Side of the Mountain, she writes that her father claimed the locomotive was not found in the original recovery effort, and there were no more attempts at that time to find it. From the viewpoint of Kansas Pacific Railroad, once their recovery attempt costs approached $18,000, it would have been better business to buy a replacement engine than to spend more money to recover the lost one. Others have taken up the quest, including a large oil company, in 1985. Reports indicate the company set off explosive charges in a one-mile grid, the creek bed plus adjoining fields, taking into consideration possible changes in the creek's course over the years. Evidence of a large metallic object in the vicinity of the accident reportedly was discovered, but no locomotive was found. The mystery beckons. In January 1989, Clive Cussler, author of Raise the Titanic and other novels, and his organization National Underwater and Marine Agency, NUMA, NUMA, organized a renewed search. Although Cussler has found 54 sunken ships, including one beneath the Galveston, Texas parking lot, and another under an Arkansas soybean field, as well as a dirigible, this was his first search for a locomotive. His novel, Night Probe, is partially based on the accident at Kiowa Creek. Aiding Cussler were a surprising number of volunteers, archaeologists, geologists, geophysicists, video store owners, railroad and history buffs, accountants, computer scientists, farmers, reporters, and other interested spectators, including several people from Australia. A total of over 200 people attended the search. Search equipment ranged from ground-penetrating radar, magnetometers, and metal detectors, to shovels, picks, heavy equipment, and even a dowsing rod. Cussler's primary tool was the magnetometer, a device which can effectively detect the magnetic field of metallic objects at depths of up to 50 feet. The searchers found portions of an old railroad trestle, the remnants of a capped oil well, a handful of railroad spikes, a coal shovel, a chamber pot, a coupler, and assorted junk, but no locomotive. Terry Capps, whose family owns the land on which the search was conducted, says her grandfather told stories of the missing locomotive. "We believe," she says, "I think they've been on it, but they just haven't dug far enough." Engine 51's fate remains a mystery. Craig Dirigo, NUMA's director of special projects, says the Rocky Mountain News reported in 1880, just 2 years after the accident, that the coal tender had been found, but the engine was never seen again. Cussler thinks that if the locomotive had been retrieved, it would have been reported in the newspapers. No one has found any report anywhere about a retrieval. Haunting questions linger. Does the 50-ton iron horse still slumber in the sand of Kiowa Creek, awaiting some enterprising searcher's probe? Exactly where is the locomotive? When will it be found? Who will find it? Why has it eluded so many searchers for 111 years? Will the mystery at Kiowa Creek ever be solved? True West Magazine, October 2000 edition. Bogus Bigfoot by Thomas E. Farmer. My grandmother was hardly a confrontational lady. In fact, I never witnessed her object much to anything, so I was startled when she told me I was wrong. "You don't know," she snapped. "I knew the ones who told the stories, and that Indian was real." I stammered a quick withdrawal and hastened to admit the limitations of my Johnny-come-lately authorities. I did not agree, but certainly had no desire to upset my 85-year-old grandmother. She needed to believe what she believed. I had completed a research project on a popular area myth and had, to my satisfaction, proved it was just that, a myth. I thought exposing tall tales would be appreciated, but I learned a lesson. I had rubbed the fact against belief in a person that lived too close to the time of the legend. The legend of Bigfoot is hardly unique to the southwest corner of the state of Idaho, but this frontier region has a particularly colorful version. As with all myths, it usually begins with a kernel of truth, and so it was with the large Paiute leader named Howluck that stirred up trouble along the famed Snake River near the present town of Weiser, Idaho. His short-lived career was dispersed by the military campaign of 1868 as he was captured in Eastham, Oregon, and sent to a reservation. There are fairly reliable stories of his speed on foot, and it was rumored he chased jackrabbits with a stick. As far as factual history, his warlike activities were limited, but he probably was the seed to a fabricated legend. The central tale that fixed these stories into Idaho history was fiction concocted in San Quentin Prison in 1877. An elaborate account of witnessing the killing of a large Indian named Bigfoot was submitted to the Idaho Tri-Weekly Statesman and subsequently printed on November 14, 1878 by one William T. Anderson, who claimed to encounter the event as he was traveling to the Boise Basin. According to a story, which was published in two narrative pieces, Anderson watched as local Silver City, Idaho resident John Wheeler shot the notorious Indian. Bigfoot, with two other warriors, awaited the stagecoach along the Reynolds Creek Trail, and Anderson watched as someone began firing into them, killing one instantly and sending the other running. Bigfoot turned and charged up the hill, carrying a shotgun, and bellowed threats at the concealed man, who then stepped in full view, firing his Henry repeater. The article goes on to describe in graphic detail the exchange of fire and the 16 shots striking Bigfoot before he collapsed. As he lay dying, Wheeler cautiously approached, as did Anderson. And with all the proper dramatics, Bigfoot told his life story in his closing moments. He tells of his mixture of Indian, African, and white blood, and his early life in the Cherokee Nation. His name was Star Wilkinson, and he came west by way of immigrant train. Along the route, he became infatuated with a young woman whose suitor increasingly disliked his interest. In the story, Bigfoot, Wilkinson, kills the man along the Snake River in Idaho and flees into the Owyhee Mountains, where he joins a renegade band. His account includes waging war against all whites in the area, especially after a vigilante raid kills his own child. At the conclusion of his confession, he begs Wheeler not to cut off his feet, as it is implied there is a considerable bounty on them. Wheeler unselfishly foregoes the handsome reward by promising not to mutilate the body. Before Bigfoot expires, he relays a mythological prophecy he was given about a snake with a white head pursuing him in his previous dreams. The story ends with Wheeler and Anderson lowering the body by rope into a rock crag along with his gun, after, of course, measuring him. Wheeler conveniently had a tape line and rule in his pocket and found Bigfoot to be 59 inches at the chest, 6 feet, 8.5 inches tall, and fist of 17 and a half inches. His 18-inch foot was mentioned last. This tale was told and retold so many times after 1878 that it formed a life of its own, expanding and varying according to region. The stories liberally substituted motifs from other legends, blending even more bizarre events. Many of the stories ended with new players killing the dreaded Bigfoot, while others simply relayed the horrors of his cruelty. Most had elements of superhuman feats, such as swimming the Snake River to outdistance his pursuer, or outrunning deer for days at a time. One tale has him walking barefoot over 100 miles in 40-degree weather. To this day, you can go to the town of Nampa, Idaho, and find those who are convinced the town was legitimately named after Bigfoot. Actually, the Shoshone term Nam, foot, and Puh, which can mean footprint, was a scheme by local businesses to promote a budding town and contrived the title Chief Nampa for good measure. Another valley town erected a statue to the villain Bigfoot in 1974, featuring a special dedication in which the governor of Idaho gave a Preserving Idaho history speech. My grandmother has long since passed, as have most that believed the mythological story, and it appears safe to discuss the roots of this tall tale. The truth is, all accounts of this story eventually track their way back to this isolated story that ran in a Boise paper by this man named Anderson. He claimed to be a carpenter in Silver City at the time of the event, but records will not support this. In the article's byline, he lists his home as Fisherman's Cove, Humboldt County, California. But again, no evidence is to be found. Property assessments, census reports, death notices, or any other means of identification denies each and every claim made by the named Anderson. The man appears fictional. Wheeler, however, is not fictional. He made a reputation for himself in the Northwest, but none of it would be considered admirable. He generally is reported to be a thief, stage robber, and murderer. There is record of his arrest in Boise, Idaho in 1868, for participating in a stage robbery in the Blue Mountains of Oregon. There is evidence that he was the lead suspect in the murder of a man in a robbery near the Wood River in central Idaho the following year, and served an 8-year sentence in a California institution where he most likely made up the story. He made a brief try at an honest trade, learning dentistry in prison, and on release opened a practice in San Rafael, California. It was short-lived, and he was soon arrested for his participation in a robbery and murder near Mendocino City. On May 14, 1880, he was sentenced to hang. Wheeler beat the legal system to the punch as he ingested poison and died only days before he was to be executed. One would have to swallow hard to believe this to be the principled man who refused a $2,000 bounty on the feet of Bigfoot, which, incidentally, is a bounty that also cannot be verified by historical record. This story was well-rooted as the Boise Valley built its way to civilization in the late 1800s. Its potent effect was so ingrained that all Idaho school children were taught it far into the mid-1900s. The impact this story generated in the early days ensured its own etched imprint. At the end, it became a story of fun and intrigue and began to be told much like a ghost story. Now, it is mostly gone altogether. There is an element to the legend that remains like a bad taste and reminds us of historical evidence in which we should not take pride. The fact that the story smacks of racial overtones is not surprising, considering our past, but the lasting popularity of the story is a sobering statement. Bigfoot was presented as playing to the settlers' prejudices and fears. He was a half-breed outlaw, and his approaches to the white women on the train were viewed as a characterological flaw. The fabricator of its story takes special notice to describe Bigfoot's kinky hair and presents him as childlike, as was a popular characterization of Native Americans. Throughout the story, Bigfoot bests the white man only by way of his supernatural strength and size. An Idaho population that regarded the Indian as less than human and needing to be eradicated happily accepted this angle. Frontier generals, local residents, and newspapers openly encouraged Indian hunting, and the citizens of Silver City formed an Indian hunting committee in 1866. The committee advertised payment of $100 for a buck scalp and $50 for the scalp of a squaw. It should not go unsaid that they also were eager to pay $25 for any scalp of an Indian child. With this kind of attitude, it is not difficult to understand the tone of the Bigfoot tale, but the gullibility of the Idaho people still remains a troubling issue regarding an obvious bogus story. I can only conclude it remained popular so long because many people wanted to believe it. Oh, did I mention that after some of my older acquaintances read this, I once again will be forced to listen to why my dismissal of the Bigfoot myth is a mistake? So be it. True West Magazine, October 1999 edition. Navajos and the Witch by Judy Cox Finney. In 1897, Richard Wetherill, famed cowboy discoverer of the Anasazi cliff dwellings of Mesa Verde, realized the small ranch he shared with his parents and brothers in Mancos Valley, Colorado, was not able to support such a large number of people. So along with his wife, Marietta, and several other assorted family members, he headed south to a place that held great interest for this archaeologist cowboy, a desert canyon in New Mexico called Chaco Canyon. There, he intended to ranch and to do what he liked best, excavate and preserve ancient prehistoric ruins. For Richard Wetherill, Chaco Canyon was a paradise with its hundreds of prehistoric ruins, many having never been explored. For his wife, Marietta Palmer Wetherill, Chaco Canyon would also hold great promise, but not with the Native Americans of the past, but with the modern inhabitants of this dry area, the Navajos. Marietta Palmer Wetherill can best be described as a small dynamo who, even up to her death in the 1950s, had a deep abiding desire to learn about people, especially those people whose culture was vastly different than her own. Born to Sidney Laverne and Elizabeth Ann Hogue Palmer, Marietta grew up in a family where music was a part of her daily existence. Her father played in John Philip Sousa's band, while her mother was an accomplished pianist who played before Queen Victoria. After her father made money in real estate investments, he packed up his family and headed out to explore America. Using their music to break the ice with the Native Americans they encountered in their travels, the Palmer family soon found themselves visiting the newly discovered Anasazi cliff dwellings of Mesa Verde and the Wetherill family. It took little time for Marietta, strong-willed, full of life, and ready for anything, to capture Richard's heart. Although Richard was 37 years old and Marietta 19 when they met, age seemed to never play a part in their short marriage. Unfortunately, violence did. Richard would be shot dead in Chaco Canyon in 1910, and Marietta would leave the area the next year to raise her family, without ever remarrying, in the cooler climate of Colorado. But before the tragedy came the discoveries made by Richard and the great anthropological work done by Marietta. Besides their ranch, the Wetherills established a trading post in Chaco Canyon. It was Marietta who took care of most of the post's business with the Navajos, while Richard worked to understand the great civilization that had vanished from the area nearly 1,000 years ago. Marietta's desire to learn about other cultures, her open-mindedness, her musical talent, and, as she puts it, "I had a small tongue, so I learned languages easy," created a strong bond between her and the Navajos. The Navajos trusted the Anglo woman who the Apache Geronimo once mistook for one of his tribe, and she in turn made sure they were treated fairly whenever they came into her trading post. As a matter of fact, so completely did she gain the Navajos' trust that they eventually included her as part of their tribe. As a member of their tribe, Marietta was allowed to observe many of the most secret rituals, many of which no longer are practiced. In later years, Marietta would both write and speak of these ceremonies in books, magazines, and a series of oral tapes that can be found at the University of New Mexico. Needless to say, Marietta made many Navajo friends. It was because of Marietta's relationship with one particular Navajo and the trust of the entire tribe that Marietta found herself witness to one of the most remarkable, albeit gruesome, rituals ever performed by the Native Americans in modern times. A popular and prosperous Navajo medicine man by the name of Hosteen Hatali Nez Begay and his family traded at the Wetherill Post in Chaco Canyon. Laughing and telling jokes, the whole Begay family lit up the post with their lively banter every time they came in. Hatali Nez thought so highly of Marietta that he even gave her a gift of some beautiful silver conches that are still in the Wetherill family today. As Hatali Nez grew older, he began to feel bad, but he kept on holding his biji, or doctoring sings. This was not a good thing. One day he doctored a woman, and she died. Then he failed to cure a boy who had a broken arm. With each failure, Hatali Nez felt worse, and the tribe began to doubt him. "Some evil spirit is troubling him, and he's not making any cures," tribal members said. Hatali Nez sat up at night, looking into the fire and asking the Great Spirit what was the matter with him. He would sing for hours on end, but things got worse. Called on to give a fire dance for a man, the man died after the ceremony. Something had to be done. "Call Hosteen Dedilwishin Begay to come and give Umta to cure Hatali Nez of this evil spirit," ordered one of Natali Nez's wives. And so they held the Umta ceremony. People who were not related to Hatali donated the use of their hogans, where sand paintings and songs were held at night. And then just before dawn, everyone stole away from the hogan, pulling Hatali on a travois behind a horse to drag him over brush to force the evil spirit out of him. And then they would race to get into another hogan before the evil spirit could catch up with them, chanting Umta all the way. They all remembered to duck through a pinyon branch archway in front of each hogan while chanting so that the evil spirit wouldn't follow them. Masks and paints were worn by the singers so as to disguise them. Hundreds of men and women loped along on their ponies from hogan to hogan, painted and masked, chanting and singing away the evil spirit. By the time they came to the last hogan, they were dancing and screaming like mad people. Inside that last hogan, Hatali Nez was covered with cedar bark and pinyons, while others slept near him on the ground. The next morning, Hatali Nez walked from that hogan cured because Hosteen Dedilwishin said he was. "Now everything will be fine," said the Navajos. And indeed, everything was fine for a year. Then another patient died. Natali Nez's family ran away in the night to avoid the evil spirit that had returned. While they were gone, their Paiute slaves stole their sheep. No one would even speak to Hatali Nez, much less hire him. Natali Nez began to worry and not eat. Not even Hosteen Dedilwishin could find a reason for his problems or a way to remove the evil spirit. Shunned, Hatali Nez left his family and moved into a cave. Marietta heard about Hatali from other Navajos who came to trade at her post. Worried, she decided to take him some food. She tracked him to a small cave. Once a handsome figure, Hatali Nez had turned many a maid's eye. His black hair shone like a raven's spring coat. Falling to his waist, his hair accented a strong chin, the determined set of his jaw, and the dark eyes that could dance with laughter one moment and turn dark with anger the next. Children would run at his feet as he walked, arms open to the youngsters, a tall, straight, muscular body gleaming in the desert sun. But now he sat hunched over, wasting away, his gray hair matting atop a dirty, wrinkled, skull-like face. "Why are you living here?" Marietta asked, holding back her tears. "My wives, children, mother, everyone's left me. I'm in such trouble. That evil spirit won't leave. It's killing me." "Come down and live with us then," Marietta offered. "No, evil will come to you then," he said as he turned his face away from his friend. "What can I do to help you?" Marietta's words seemed to fall upon deaf ears. "You know I'm going to die," he finally admitted. "I'd rather die here, but the Navajo have declared me a witch. They are afraid of the evil spirit inside of me." All that winter, Marietta took her sick friend food and tried to get him to come down and live with her family, but he refused. Finally, the day came when he was to ride back into the canyon and face the ceremony awaiting all witches. Marietta wanted to be with her friend in this time of need, but Diddlewishin would not hear of it. "It's not a nice thing to see," he told her. "It will make you sick. There's only a few Navajo who see such things." "But my brother saw one last year," Marietta pleaded. "A man can see these things," argued the Navajo medicine man. "What if you are pregnant?" No matter how hard she argued, even when she called upon her adopted Navajo father, Marietta was forbidden to take her friend's side in the ceremony. Finally, it was her husband Richard who reminded the Navajo leaders of their trust in Marietta and of the fact that one reason she had been made Navajo was to allow her to see the ceremonies so that she could accurately and without bias explain them to other non-Navajos. Richard's argument swayed the men, and Marietta, wearing a black blanket, rode her favorite mare up Chaco Canyon to where a sun symbol had been painted upon the rock. After the medicine men had painted her face black, she was shown where to sit. Before taking her seat, Marietta went over and shook hands one last time with her old friend, something that the others didn't like. At first, all Marietta saw was Hatali Nez sitting near the wall and two or three other men all sitting by their own fire, chanting and pulling something from a buckskin bag under their blankets and sprinkling it on their fires. All else was silent, not noisy like the other ceremonies she had seen. Of course, those other ceremonies were about life, Marietta reminded herself. This one was about death. "Maybe I've gotten myself into something I can't handle," Marietta thought as she watched her old friend's sunken body shiver near the small fire. With the setting of the sun, the ceremony began. Hosteen Diddlewishin Begay got up from his fire and walked over to Hatali Nez and said something to him. Hatali Nez got up and walked over to a bed of sand they had spread on the ground. He lay down on the sand, stretched out flat, with his arms out a little ways from his body. He laid perfectly still, like he was finally at rest. Diddlewishin began to chant and use his rattles. "For the last chant, for the last chant," he chanted. "For the last time, I'm going to send a sign. For the last chant, Natani Soto, send a sign." The two other men repeated the chant. If a lizard or snake had crossed the sand, Hatali Nez would have lived. But this evening, no sign came from the Great Spirit. "Spare this man," Diddlewishin Begay raised his hands to the sky. "Spare this man." The five people held their breath. Nothing. Diddlewishin Begay dropped his hands. From the darkness, a very old woman came to Hatali Nez with something wrapped in a green leaf. She handed it to Diddlewishin Begay, who placed it into Hatali Nez's mouth. Not rising, Hatali Nez swallowed it with great difficulty. His whole body quivered twice before becoming perfectly still. Four horsemen came out from behind the rocks, faces painted, black and white horizontal lines to disguise their identities. Dismounting, each rider put a rope around one of Hatali Nez's limbs, got back onto their horses, and rode away. Before Marietta could shut her eyes, she saw one of Hatali's arms pulled off. It only took a few seconds for the sound of the horse's hooves to fade into the deep silence of the desert night. Diddlewisham Begay brought Marietta her horse. She knew there was no use in staying. She rode home to lay awake, thinking of what was occurring out there in the dark canyon. This is what the Navajo medicine man told Marietta about this ceremony. Each horseman was selected by a different medicine man. Nobody wants to do this job, but someone has to. The riders do it to help their people. The riders' identities are kept from everyone. Not even the medicine men know who all the riders are, and no one will ever tell who they were. Each man dragged his part of the body as far away from the Hogans and people as possible, staying close to a preset course. Their trails were obliterated with piled up sand and rocks so that the path would never be seen. After they start their ride, the men never look back. Just as the sun came up, they dropped the rope from the saddle and kept right on riding. Very seldom were these horses ridden again. They became Chindi horses, devil horses. North, south, east, and west. When a witch is killed, it's a bad thing. The body must be dismembered so that it can never get together again. That is the bad part about it, because when you are dismembered, you can never be a human being again. You can never be anything. Even the spirit is torn apart so that it can't go to the spirit world and come back here in another body. It's gone forever. That's the worst part. In a few months, Marietta's life was shattered by her husband's murder. She left Chaco Canyon, never to return. But her memories of the Navajos and the lifestyle stayed with her until she closed her eyes in eternal sleep. True West Magazine, October 1999. Cimarron's St. James, The Hotel with an Unsaintly Past, by Jane Choate. Western historian Robert D'Armont noted that once a legend is created, you can't kill it with a bullet. This is certainly true of humans, and in at least one instance, a hotel. Unfortunately, Henry Lambert was not aware of this when he opened the St. James Hotel in 1880 as a stage stop on the Santa Fe Trail. Lambert had been the field cook for General Ulysses S. Grant during the last half of the Civil War, and then moved on to become President Abraham Lincoln's White House chef. Following Lincoln's assassination, Lambert went to cook in the gold fields near Cimarron, New Mexico, an original part of Lucien Maxwell's land grant. Maxwell had worked as a hunter for John Fremont on two expeditions before settling down and marrying the daughter of one of the owners of what would later be called the Maxwell Land Grant. He eventually took possession of the entire former Spanish grant, which consisted of 1.7 million acres, over 2,100 square miles. For a time, this made him the largest private landholder in the Western Hemisphere. Lambert's hopes for the St. James and Cimarron were that it would be the finest hotel in the West. Accordingly, he ordered furniture, crystal and china, from France at great expense. Lambert commissioned the famous and colorful Uncle Dick Wooten to transport most of his valuable furnishings over Wooten's toll road on the Santa Fe Trail at Raton Pass. One interesting aside is that Wooten would eventually be credited with developing part of Maxwell's ranch into the town of Cimarron. At that time, the fee for one wagon on the toll road was between $1 and $1.50, and Lambert was transporting by ox cart everything from his precious china to velvet draperies, glass mirrors, marble-top tables, and four-poster beds. Many of Lambert's clients were a far cry from guests attending formal dinners in Lincoln's White House. Rather, they were a mix of ranchers, travelers, furloughed soldiers from nearby Fort Union, and some of the West's most notable lawmen and outlaws. Old hotel registers, now kept under lock and key, indicate that a who's who in the Wild West frequented the St. James. Kit Carson, Black Jack Ketchum, Frederick Remington, and Wyatt Earp are all numbered among the patrons. New Mexico Governor Lew Wallace wrote parts of Ben-Hur, and Zane Grey penned the novel Fighting Caravans while staying there. Local legend has it that outlaw Clay Allison danced naked on the bar when he had too much to drink. On August 29th, 1881, Jesse James registered under his alias R.H. Howard and stayed in room number 14. Ironically, Bob Ford James' slayer had previously stayed in that same room. All of the rooms and suites in the old part of the hotel had been restored, furnished with their original antiques, and named for those who stayed in them. Today's traveler can choose from among accommodations named for Bat Masterson, William F. Cody, Annie Oakley, and Thumbelian, the small Barnum & Bailey headliner, to name but a few. The walls of the hallways outside the second floor rooms are covered with memorabilia of former guests. There is no documentation to indicate that Billy the Kid ever stayed at the St. James, but there is one curious photograph with the following caption. Billy the Kid? Probably. John Chisholm and Pete Maxwell said it was. Certain people claim he was in Cimarron. No proof. Reading this, one can't help but remember that Billy did associate with John Chisholm during the Lincoln County War and was killed in Pete Maxwell's bedroom. There is the verified signature of Pat Garrett, however, in one of St. James's registers. Another artifact from the heyday of the St. James is a framed ballad written by Clay Allison to his wife. Oh, may you in hours of bliss, when pleasures are forgot, cast one lingering look on this, and reading, forget me not. Will you, loving Clay? According to hotel legend, the lovesick Allison wrote poetry to his wife on its walls. The above is certainly tangible proof of that legend. This image of Allison is in direct contrast to a description by Western writer-historian J. Frank Dobie, who characterized the gentleman gunfighter as quixotically independent in interpreting what constituted his rights. The more whiskey he drank, the more rights he possessed. And sometimes when he came to town, he bought a great deal of whiskey. He was generous with it, however, even insisting on his horse enjoying a fair portion. It is reported that Allison once took exception to something the local newspaper had written about him and threw the paper's printing press and all of its other equipment into the Cimarron River. The next week, the paper managed to come out with a four-page edition. The inside simply said, "Earthquake postponed." In addition to scribbling on the hotel's wallpaper, Allison must have sorely tried the patience of Henry Lambert. The same day he shot and killed Pancho Grigio in the St. James Bar, Davy Crockett II, nephew of the Alamo hero, and a sidekick killed three black soldiers from Fort Union on the hotel grounds, claiming self-defense. There were 26 killings in the early days of the St. James. Supposedly, over 400 bullet holes appeared in the ceiling of the bar, causing Lambert to install a new one consisting of two layers of hardwood covered by pressed tin. Ostensibly, this was to protect those trying to sleep on the second floor. Today, the bar is an elegant dining room, but bullet holes still dot the ceiling. Another local legend maintains that Buffalo Bill Cody met Annie Oakley in the hotel bar. She was bragging about her shooting ability, and Cody raised a coin over his head, holding it between two fingers. He told her to shoot the coin away. She did, and Cody hired her on the spot to tour with his Wild West show. According to the Cimarron Historical Society, Cody's Wild West never performed in that town, but Cody did become the godfather of Lambert's son, Fred. In addition to its colorful history, the St. James reportedly has three ghosts, which were a topic of the television series Unsolved Mysteries. Mary, wife of Henry Lambert, died shortly after the hotel opened. Several people have claimed to have communicated with her, and when she answers yes, an aroma of perfume rises in her room. Another ghost has been named the Imp by the hotel staff, who take him in stride when he levitates pitchers in the kitchen and plays with the telephones. During the filming of the television show, the ghost in room number 18 was so disagreeable that the producers prevailed upon the owners to call in a psychic. The ghost had already knocked down one of the owners, Pat Laurie, so they agreed. The psychic said that the ghost was named Thomas or J. Wright, and that he had won the hotel in a poker game, but was murdered the next day. According to the psychic, Wright believed that he still owned the hotel and resented any intrusion into his room. Mrs. Laurie was given three dates by the psychic. Upon researching them in an old hotel register, it was discovered that a T.J. Wright had indeed stayed at the hotel on those dates. Today, his room remains locked and unavailable to guests, but he seems content to remain inside and not harass visitors. Patrons of the St. James can view a video of the Unsolved Mysteries episode in the antique-filled lobby. Cimarron makes an ideal stopover for trips to other New Mexican towns whose history was often shaped by St. James inhabitants. The ruins of Fort Union, northeast of Las Vegas, can still be viewed. Between 1851 and 1891, this was the largest garrison in the Southwest, and ruts of the Santa Fe Trail can also be seen beside the ruins. Listed on the National Register of Historic Places, the St. James is open throughout the year. Cimarron is located on Route 64, midway between Raton and Taos. For today's visitor, it is difficult to imagine that on one occasion, the Las Vegas, New Mexico Gazette noted, "Everything is quiet at Cimarron. Nobody has been killed there in 3 days."
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.